On today's Central Standard, we tackle life lessons for players in the game. We'll be speaking with former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs, who recently left us for the Oakland Raiders. We'll talk about him being on opposite sidelines this coming season and hear about his local Pushing Excellence program that offers life skills training for high school athletes in the metro. I'm Jabalani LaFall. That plus, we dive into the dark art of public relations. The Public Relations Society of America has taken months to develop a new standard definition of PR. For an industry that's all about strategic communication and spin, definitions like this are kind of important. We'll hear what a local PR pro thinks of the end result of this exercise and how he actually convinced us to care. Yeah, we actually did take his pitch in the first place. Find out why on today's Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. Missouri's own Harry Truman famously said that the president is a glorified public relations man who spends his time flattering, kissing, and kicking people to get them to do what they're supposed to do anyway. So where does that leave today's public relations professional when it comes to flattering, kissing, and kicking? This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Many of those in the media might be familiar with seeing emails or getting calls from our guest today. He's Justin LaBurge, an account manager for Sturgis Word Communications. He's here today to give us the spin on how public relations is changing in today's fast-paced, information-driven environment. Welcome to the show, Justin.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us how you got into PR.
Well, I got into PR when I was 13. My mother passed away from AIDS, and I'm 32. This was in the late 80s, early 90s. And she was very active in education and outreach. And this is around the same time that Magic Johnson is making his announcement. Ryan White had just happened. And I saw firsthand through her education and outreach efforts the power of informing and transforming attitudes in a community through sharing important information that people might not have or understand or be afraid of. And I had always loved the media. I'd always loved the news. I'd always kind of liked politics. So as I got older and realized you could actually make a living doing that, I became very interested in doing that. I kind of picked up that mantle myself doing education outreach in my high school and going to school board meetings and talking and started doing interviews with the media and realized, oh gosh, I kind of like this. I'm kind of good at it. Maybe I should study that in college. So that's what I did, and here I am now.
Did you find yourself talking in sound bites at an early age?
Occasionally, yes. I distinctly remember when I went to a school board meeting once, there were two groups. We were lobbying for more education around HIV/AIDS, safe sex, things like that. And there were two groups. There was one group that was a little more militant and activist, and we were just really pushing. My group was kind of more just pushing. We want the education. We don't necessarily need the condoms in schools and that kind of thing. That's what they really wanted. The school board was a little reticent on that. And I remember doing the interview with my local paper, and my quote was, you know, a person can go out and buy condoms, but you can't buy education. And that was kind of what I had formed in my head ahead of time. That's what I wanted to get across. And there it was, the pull quote in the story. And that was kind of the first time I had really experienced that.
Do you have that up laminated somewhere?
I actually do. I have it in my scrapbook at home.
What's the biggest misconception, Justin, about public relations? Your story is kind of non-traditional, very ambitious, very altruistic, very inspirational, whereas a lot of people got into it because they wanted to be in the mix.
Well,
so what's the most misconceptions about your profession?
Well, I think there's a couple misconceptions. I think number one is that we're all spin doctors. I think that's a term you hear a lot. And, you know, in some realms, particularly the political realm, I think that's certainly fair and true oftentimes. And that might also be true within the world of the publicist. But while those are the most prominent examples that people think of, the person dealing with celebrities or the person dealing with politicians, that there is this huge industry out there that works every day to help all types of organizations share their messages, interact with all the different publics, stakeholder groups that they deal with on a daily basis, and do it effectively. And And most organizations want to do the right thing and want to have good relationships with their customers, their employees, their shareholders, the communities they serve. And that a public relations professional's job is to get that information out there, be truthful, be transparent, be accurate, be informative, and build those relationships, not just like on a transactional level, but on a long-term, we want to be in partnership. We truly want to be in relationship. And I think a lot of people don't realize that about the vast majority of people practicing in this field.
But you have to admit, Justin, that Spin Doctor is actually a pretty cool name. You're a doctor, you're spinning, you're a spin doctor.
Yeah, it's not a very good band, but it's an interesting title. But but honestly, it's not what we do most of the time. At least I can speak for myself. I can speak for the 200 professionals in our local chapter of PRSA, and saying, you know, we honestly want to get truthful and accurate information out there. And if you get truthful and accurate information out there, generally it's going to benefit everyone.
PRSA, by the way, is not a group that writes essays about PR, but is the Public Relations Society of America, for which you have just been elected president.
President-elect. I'll be the president
next
year.
You've just been elected. You're the president-elect of the local arm of PRSA, which recently, on a national level, tried to update the definition of PR.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, apparently the last time they had updated the definition was in 1982, and honestly, I don't even remember what that definition was, but I remember in seeing it, I think it said something about helping an organization mutually adapt or something. It was kind of odd and a little outdated. They tried several times to update it, but to no avail. So they went out, kind of did like a Mad Libs type thing where they asked their members, here, fill in this sentence with a few keywords. They collected those keywords and then they built several definitions around that. Then they refined those definitions and put it out to a vote. And where they ended up...
How many people were involved in this process, by the way?
Oh, gosh. You know, I don't know. PRSA has approximately 22,000 members across the country.
Was there a special steering committee for this definition?
There was. There was a whole website. I think it was prdefinition.org or prfdefinition.prsa.org, something like that. You can, if you Google it, you can find it.
And drum roll, what did they come up with as the new standard definition of PR?
Public relations is a strategic communication process that builds mutually beneficial relationships between an organization and its publics.
Wow, Justin.
Yeah.
That is really, really boring. That's it? After all that work? After all of the committee work?
Well, you know, I think, you know, it hasn't been universally popular, but I think it's a heck of a lot better than what they had before. And I think, like anything, when you do it by committee and you try and crowdsource it, which is a thing with social media that I think you have to do.
That long explanation, which it doesn't even really make sense. What does it actually even mean?
Well, I think there's a couple key words in there. I think obviously communication, but strategic and mutually beneficial, I think, are the two key words in there. And from the strategic perspective, effective PR is not something you do willy-nilly. It's something you take the time to think about. If you want to build a relationship with someone over the long term, you don't just go out and react. You think about what it is that we're trying to accomplish, what it is this other person is trying to accomplish, what matters to them, and how can we bring ourselves together, which brings to the mutually beneficial part, which is, you know, we're all out here. We have needs, we have wants, we have attitudes, values, beliefs, experiences. And presumably, if an organization considers you to be their public, that means, you know, they need you. And you probably need them, you know, to use the KCUR example. You have a lot of different publics. And certainly one of them is your listeners and your donors and your underwriters. And those folks need a good radio station in Kansas City. They need good news and information. And you need listeners and you need support.
They use publics and relations in the definition, the really, really wordy definition. Really, like, this was the best they could come up with?
Well, you know, I can't speak for them, and I can't speak for you know, how they ended up there. And I know some people don't like using the words to define the words, and I tend to fall into that camp. But I think overall, it's better than where it was. And you know, you're trying to wrangle a lot of different folks who have a lot of different opinions about what's going on.
Right. It is wide ranging.
Yeah.
Ambiguous. nebulous and far-reaching enough
right.
to be something that has the perfect public relations signature,
exactly.
as a matter of fact. Speaking of which, tell us about the different types of approaches in PR, the different types, publicists, consumer, issues, advocacy, corporate.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, as I said before, I think the ones people tend to think most about are the political person or the publicist who works with celebrities. But in addition to that, you have all these different subspecializations. You have people that work more on consumer type things. For example, you know, the Star did a fantastic story a couple weeks ago about Tide launching those new Tide pods. And you've got a lot of PR people that are out there trying to place that on Oprah, or well, not anymore on Oprah, but, you know, the Today Show or whatever, and doing more of that consumer-oriented type stuff. You have corporate communicators who are working either in-house for a corporation or through an agency to represent a corporation's interests and help interact with the communities where they have operations, their customers, their shareholders. You have folks who are really advancing issues. You think about something like renewable energy or you know, any issue that's out there. You have people that are trying to get their information about that issue out there. Government has an obligation to tell its citizens what's going on, to operate transparently. Every city of any size has a public information officer, pardon me, which is, you know, what they call a public relations person. Not-for-profits as well have, you know, PR professionals who help reach out to their funding organizations, the communities they serve. So there's a lot of different.
And we've heard from just about all of them at the show. I've heard from just about all of them throughout my career as well. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Justin LaBerge, an account manager at Sturgis Word Communications. He's in a sort of information twilight zone today as a public relations professional doing an interview about public relations. We don't have any spooky music to cue up, but it's just a conversation for now. Justin, what is good PR and what is bad PR?
Well, I think what's good PR and what's bad PR depends on what you're trying to accomplish, which I think goes back to that strategic part. When you start a project, you have to ask yourself, okay, what is the organization trying to do here? And then based on that, who are the publics that we need to talk to? What do they think about us currently? What do we need? You know, what do we need to change in attitude, behavior, value? You know, and how are we going to go about informing them, getting that information out to them? And depending on how you answer those questions will largely determine what good PR is.
Well, under certain circumstances, when would the maxim of even bad PR is good PR apply?
You know,
and a deep breath.
In my particular areas of practice, I struggle to think of a time when that is true. About the only time I can think of in what I do that would be true would be if you had an issue that was so obscure that people just weren't talking about it at all.
Give us an example.
You know, thinking back to you know, my earlier example with HIV/AIDS, at the time when you have a disease that no one's talking about, right? President Reagan wouldn't even say the word. If you can just get it out there so you can start the conversation, then maybe we can go from there. Now, that's not ideal. That's a very limited example. And sometimes I think with publicists, maybe sometimes they tend to think as long as I get your name in the paper and it's spelled correctly, that's a good day. But generally speaking, for what I do and for most of my clients, we're trying to be a lot more strategic about it. And we really want to go out and, you know, talk to folks, share our side of the story, get them thinking about issues that maybe they haven't thought about before because, you know, life is busy and complicated and most people don't have time to think about everything.
A lot of people think of public relations simply in that narrow definition of publicity, just getting the name out there, just getting the spin out there or the message out there. How has the profession changed in our era of all everything all the time?
Yeah, it's a great question. A lot of people say that social media has transformed public relations, and I think to a certain extent that's true. But I think if what you really look at what they're saying when you had a top-down kind of media structure and there was, you know, there's three news affiliates, there's one newspaper, and You know, you could have more of a command and control type model. But that was never really, going back to that original definition we talked about, that's really not the spirit of that definition. If you're building mutually beneficial relationships and being responsive, first of all, it's not just all about media relations. There are so many other relationships to build. And,
Uh-oh, PR guy stumped.
No, but you have so many other channels through which to build those relationships. And if you're doing a good job of it, whether you're doing a good job before, you're doing a good job now, you're always being transparent and engaging with people and giving people the information they need and trying to solve their problems. And I think that was true before if you were doing it right. And I think now, because of social media, you no longer can get away with that other way of doing it.
Would you say there's a greater tendency now among PR professionals to try to ride the wave of a developing story? In instance, inserting a client into a developing story or pitching their take on a news item to get them out there?
Well, that's a classic, you know, that's a PR 101 type approach to things. You know, every day when I come into the office, you know, the first thing I do is look at the newspaper and see what's going on and see if there are any opportunities among developing stories to put my clients out there. So that's always been the case. But certainly now more so, you know, it's not just doing it in the morning when you open the newspaper. It's doing it all day long, keeping your Twitter feed open, seeing how that story develops over the course of the day.
Is it a challenge to keep up with a developing conversation happening in real time?
It sure is. You know, thank heavens for mobile devices and your iPad and things like that. But if it weren't for Google Alerts and staying on top of it, you get behind pretty quick.
Well, Justin, we're going to put you on the hot seat here. If you don't feel hot enough already, let's take a couple of real-world examples and how you'd handle them. Let's start with the pink slime controversy, pink slime versus lean beef trimmings. We had a show on that yesterday where we talked about the nomenclature and semantics behind that. You can go to kcur.org and check that out, by the way.
Absolutely.
Little plug, learning from the PR guy. Let's start with the pink slime controversy. What's your take as a PR guy?
Well, you know, there was actually a really interesting article in the LA Times yesterday about this. And I think there are a couple challenges here. Number one, you're dealing with a food additive. You're not dealing with a product that you go buy off the shelf. So a lot of the classic tips you might give someone don't really apply as much. Another challenge I think you face is folks have gotten further and further away from their food supply and understanding how food is made, where food comes from. And so you have an awareness issue there. Stipulating to those two things, I think, again, transparency is always key. If you look at pink slime, it's kind of nasty to think about.
It's
process.
Very nasty to think about.
Yeah, but, you know, there. I don't know about you. I love sausage. It's delicious.
wow. Now, let me challenge you with something here. Yeah. Is transparency always important, or is the appearance of transparency always important?
Well, I think transparency is important. I think, obviously, and not the appearance of it, but actual transparency. Now, there are limitations to that, of course. I mean, there certain things are confidential. Certain things are proprietary. There's intellectual property that you want to protect. Employees have confidentiality. There are a lot of reasons that you might not be able to share something. Of course, if you're a publicly traded company, there's a lot of reasons that you don't want to impact a stock price, or you have ethical considerations. But setting those aside, or not setting them aside, but taking those into consideration, you still need to be transparent. I think if folks know what something is and it's normalized, going back to, like I said, with sausage, people for the most part know what's in sausage, and maybe some people don't like it. But
so would you divert the conversation by saying, hey, I love sausage, man. We're talking about an additive. We're not talking about this tangible, juicy thing I have in my hand right now. Would you redirect the conversation?
No, I think you have to start earlier. I think the challenge is what has happened here is you have violated people's expectations. People don't realize what they're getting, and now they feel like one's been pulled over on them, whereas with the sausage example, people know what's there. So you have to start earlier. And you know, if you're forthright from the beginning, then people aren't shocked and dismayed later. Because in this age, like you said earlier, with social media and the 24/7, information's going to get out there eventually.
What about more sort of black and white issues, environmental issues, such as the BP oil spill?
Yeah, well,
not much of a spin you can do on that, but people tried.
Right. Well,
how do you handle that?
I think the challenge there is, when you're in a crisis situation, the most important thing you can do, there are several basic things you do in any crisis. Number one, you tell folks what's happening. Here's what's happening as best you know. You don't speculate. You don't guess at facts you're not sure about. You tell people what you know, and you tell people what you don't know. Second thing you do is you say you're sorry. And when you say you're sorry, you mean you're sorry. And if you don't mean you're sorry and you don't mean to do the right thing, then game over. It's not going to work. So you say we're sorry. And then you say, here's what we're doing to fix it. And again, be truthful. Here's what we're doing to fix it. Here are the unknown variables. We're still working on those. And lastly, here's what we're going to do to make sure it doesn't happen again.
How do you, as a public relations professional, feel about the culture of apology? People seem to say they're sorry at the drop of a hat.
Well, I think it's important.
For stuff that they actually meant.
Yeah. Well, I think that goes back to what I said earlier, which is when you say you're sorry, actually be sorry. I think in some situations where people are apologizing for, I think that starts to get more into the political realm. Politicians who get caught saying the wrong thing.
Well, there's also comedians such as Tracy Morgan or mm-hmm. somebody who might say a racial slur or a sexual slur or, you know, something like that.
Right.
It seems to be an apology-driven culture. That seems to be a mandate these
days. Right. Well, and you know, I'll be honest, you know, when it comes to more of the celebrities and that kind of thing, that's not my area of expertise. But I know from an organizational perspective, when you make a mistake and you operate under the assumption that an organization didn't mean to make that mistake, they genuinely are sorry they made that mistake. Most organizations want to do the right thing most of the time. And they want to make it right. And if you operate from that basis in those situations, you can manage and recover.
I like that wordplay, man. Most organizations want to do the right thing most of the time. It says a lot.
Well, I mean, I think back to when I was in sixth grade and my science teacher told me anytime you see the word always or never on a test, it's probably false because nothing is always or never. So.
But what happens when you come up against a case that is an emotionally charged case that is pervasive in the media, that brings up passion, issues such as the Joe Paterno mm-hmm. case at Penn State with mm-hmm. the molestation?
Yeah. Well, in that situation, I think that brings up an important point, which is I think when a lot of these cases come up, people say, oh, that's a PR nightmare. And one of the things that PRSA came out and said after the Penn State thing, which I really appreciate, is that it's not a PR problem. Yes, there are PR implications, obviously. But this is an organizational problem. This is something that, you know, PR doesn't just come in and whitewash over things. In fact, if you had effective PR, perhaps an organization like that, you have a culture where people feel safe reporting up the chain, disclosing information. Perhaps if you had an environment where people felt safe to do that and there was more communication, that stops a lot earlier and doesn't go on for so long. That being said, I think now what you need to do, at least from what I've seen, they've done a pretty good job in, firing people responsible, saying they're sorry, doing things to fix it, cooperating with the investigation, and trying to move forward.
So does good PR mean having to say you're sorry?
Sometimes. But when it's the right thing to do and when it's warranted, but...
We're on with Justin LaBerge, an account manager at Sturgis Word Communications and the president-elect of the Greater Kansas City arm of the Public Relations Society of America. We have some listener comments coming in. Gabby asks, she says she read that 70% of news was generated from press releases. Do you agree with this, Justin? And is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I have no idea if that statistic is accurate. I know that a lot of news comes from news releases, and I don't think that's a bad thing, assuming that a news release is out there to help a reporter do his or her job. You all have a tremendously difficult job. I don't think people realize how hard your job is, and you have to become instant experts in all these different topics, and our job is to get you the facts, the who, what, when, where, why you need to do your fair and informed reporting.
As poor journalists need to be informed.
Well, no, I think I think there's no way that anyone can know everything about every topic.
That's true. And, that's certainly true.
You know, you don't wake up in the morning, you know, who knows what breaking news event might happen today. And you don't know everything about that industry. No one, most of us don't.
But as we learn, we can certainly pretend. Sergio writes in at centralstandard@kcur.org to ask, I was wondering what your guest thinks of when presidential candidate Mitt Romney's campaign managers commented on CNN about Mitt being like an Etch-a-Sketch and that when he wins the nomination, he will redraw himself into attracting more moderates.
Yeah.
Was that a mishap? Was that bad PR? Was that a gaffe?
Well, I think it was a gaffe, but again, not my area of expertise, but when I heard that, I thought back to when I took Political Science 101, and I think maybe the second class, my professor, this is just an axiom of all elections. In a primary, both parties go to their bases, and in a general election, they come to the center. Everybody knows that, at least, you know, everybody who follows politics. That's and yet, when he said that, yeah, he probably shouldn't have said that. It's not the best thing in the world to say, and it certainly doesn't help given Mitt Romney's challenges. Pardon me, that the other candidates have said, you know, he's a flip-flop or whatever. But the idea that the media and all the other politicians just react like, oh my gosh, I've never heard this. This is preposterous. I have the vapors. I can't, you know, come on. That's how it's played. And you know, kind of shame on the 24-hour cable news networks for turning this into something that really isn't.
So here comes a real whammo, Justin LaBerge.
Okay.
A kind of show within a show within a show question.
Okay.
If you were preparing me to be interviewed by Jabalani LaFall, based on what we've discussed here, based on the pace of the conversation, what would you tell me as your client about Jabalani's line of questioning?
Well, the thing we tell our clients about KCUR is that it's very different than a three-minute segment when you go on another radio station or if you go into a TV station. You have, you know, a half hour, maybe an hour. That presents some really fantastic opportunities, also presents some challenges. I think this show in particular, it's an opportunity to do something different. You guys have a very eclectic mix. So you can explore some more fun topics that maybe you couldn't do someplace else. The challenge, though, is you have to come up with that fun topic, which requires, you know, folks to think a lot harder than they might otherwise.
But once I'm in the studio with Jabalani LaFall, what should I, Jabalani LaFall, look out for in an interview with that guy?
Well, time goes fast. I think, you know, at least in my experience, you don't do, there aren't a lot of gotcha questions or that kind of thing. It's generally speaking, I find Jabalani, you and all your hosts at KCUR to do a great job of just having interesting conversations. And I think that's the key. Come in, have a conversation, have a point of view, have a message you want to get across, but go with the conversation, have fun, and enjoy.
Justin, I might need your advice because I think if I interviewed myself, I would eat my face in an interview. I would eat Jabalani's face. Our guest is Justin LaBerge, Sturgis Word Communication. He's an account manager there, also the president-elect of the Public Relations Society of America, which recently updated its definition of PR to something undefinable. Thank you for coming on our show.
Thanks for having me.
And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk with a former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs about his new position with an AFC rival and teaching life skills to professional athletes. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Next month, the NFL draft, several lives will change at that event forever. Cameras will flash, dreams will be realized, jerseys and hats presented to screaming fans. But our guest today talks to us about what comes after that for the player as a person. And joining us now is Lamont Winston, former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs. He has joined the Oakland Raiders as director of player engagement there. Tell us about your position with the Chiefs and the similar post you've now taken with the Oakland Raiders. And welcome to the show, by the way, Mr. Winston.
Thank you for having me, Jabalani. Good morning to you and everyone there in Kansas City. You know, the role of player engagement is really an opportunity for me to be able to help young athletes transition into the National Football League, as well as those veteran players who live in there. You know, life's a little bit different. When you're in the National Football League, everything is accelerated and dissected, if you will. So it's really trying to help them to learn how to navigate through those challenges so they can maximize the opportunity and ultimately prepare them for transition when the cheering stops.
There's a slight difference in the title, the one you had from the Chiefs Development. The other is engagement here at the Raiders. Though the position is essentially the same, break down the difference in your methodology, in your approach, Mr. Winston, between development and engagement. What do those two words mean to you?
Well, I think, Jabalani, what happened is Troy Vincent, a former great Philadelphia Eagle, is now the vice president of player engagement for the National Football League league office. And what he did when he came in, he rebranded player development into player engagement. He just felt that, you know, there needed to be three separate platforms, which was prep, which includes high school and college players, life, those guys existing in the league right now. And then next, as they transition. And so league-wide, everybody that had the player development title is now directors of player engagement. For me, the role is the same. You know, we have young men who are involved in professional sports who are also growing at the same time as men. And the challenges that they face on a constant basis are there. And so we have to make sure here in Oakland that we're, you know, helping our young men navigate these challenges so they can perform on the field as well as perform in a positive manner off the field.
You had a program here in Kansas City, and it's continuing here in Kansas City, that is along the lines of this engagement and development of young athletes with aspiration of professional stars in their eyes. Pushing Excellence, tell us about that program.
Well, that was really when I left the Chiefs. My love was still athletes, and you know, through that separation there and at One Arrowhead Drive, you know, I really looked at you know, where can I make a difference, and really making a difference gave me an opportunity to go back to the prep stage, if you will, at the high school level. Pushing Excellence is designed for all athletes, not just football, but all athletes, male and female. I think that we need to really start and put some teeth into our messages that we give our young people, because as you can see, you know, sports at the youth age is getting, you know, somewhat out of hand. Young athletes are being pushed at paces, which, you know, sometimes they can't even handle, and so the message begins to get skewed. And so, you know, I wanted to make sure that our athletes had were able to walk away from their high school experience with three core messages and three core values, if you will. And that's really what's formed Pushing Excellence, and that's effective communication, trust, and meaningful relationships, Jabalani, in that order. And I really do believe that if we young athletes can learn those three skills, learn how to put those into play, they will be successful as long as they play sports and then well after when their ball goes flat.
Break that down for us, the three stages. Can we go deeper into that, Mr. Winston? Effective
Absolutely.
Communications, what does that mean for a young person?
It's being able to, number one, in this day and age, is put down the smartphone. Okay, let's get back to using our mouths and our tongues and then our voices versus our fingers. You know, young people today, and even adults. I mean, but for the sake of convenience, we want to, you know, text and move our way. We use that mode to avoid, you know, tough discussions. We use that to express our feelings, and that's just not good, because at the end of the day, Jabalani, when these young people go out into the real working world, they can't text their way into a job.
Right.
You still have to sit down and interview. If you're going to get married one day and have a relationship, you can't text your way into that in terms of I do over the phone in front of a priest. I mean, you still have to get up on the altar and say, you know, I do. You know, you have to talk to the doctors when you begin to have children. So, you know, that effective communication, that piece cannot be lost. And so, you know, young athletes today, I mean, we have some stats where, you know, nine out of 10 kids under the age of 18 would rather text than talk.
Wow.
Okay. They sent over 3,900 texts a month.
That's pretty crazy. So
most, how about this one? Most young people under the age of 18 can text blindfold with 90%+ accuracy.
How do you think that happened? It's a little bit outside the purview, and we'll get to the next step.
Okay.
But how do you think this happened? We used to be told to go outside and ride our bikes or go play stickball or
correct.
Play football in the middle of the street and take a break when the cars came down the street. But
correct.
What happened?
Well, you know, again, you know, progress, technology, it moves at fast paces. I mean, there was a time when DVDs were, you know, the thing to have. Well, you know, you don't even have DVDs anymore, really. I mean, you can get everything online. So I think, you know, it's just convenience. It's convenience, and it's the essence of right now.
Has this changed the ethic in sports among young athletes as well?
Well, yeah, think about it. I mean, we have athletes, pro athletes, Twittering. We have young athletes Twittering in college. We, you know, they're having negative results from that as well. I mean, and damaging, sometimes career damaging. We want to air our feelings and express ourselves like right now. We don't even stop to think about what we're going to say. We just push on emotion because emotion is just a button away.
And that can be a biggest problem, as we found with Ocho Cinco tweeting from the sidelines in the middle of a game and being reprimanded for that and having that sort of unprecedented culture. And then kids maybe perhaps thinking that that's okay because he did that.
And that's okay. Now, in hindsight, what's happened to him is that once he realized, because he was kind of the first pro athlete to really kind of get that thing out there, but once he realized the damaging effects, he was educated himself and found that, you know, he could use that in a positive manner. He, at one point, I don't know if that's still true today, but at one point, he had the most Twitter followings of any athlete in the world.
Right.
Okay,
right.
And so what that did for his marketability was tremendous outside the stripes. And so, again, technology is a good thing. But again, you know, when you can put smartphones in the hands of young people, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, 10-year-olds, and you're giving them the power to connect with the world, that's scary.
The entire world. The entire world.
That's scary.
One of some of the biggest misconceptions young athletes have about life as a potential pro. As you get them ready for life, some of them have their mind fixated on being a pro. So what's the biggest misconception that you hope to stamp out right away when you come in with a program such as Pushing Excellence?
I understand that sports, you know, you need to be able to control what you can control. And right now you can control your high school experiences, your youth experiences. It's so competitive. There's nothing promise to you in terms of being a pro. Let's get through it high school and maximize high school at the highest level to give yourself a chance to go to college. I mean, you mentioned pros, you skipped right over college. How about go to college? I mean, you got to go to there are steps that you then you have to prove yourself in college, both on and off the field and in the classroom. So the misconception is that, you know, my talent and everybody patting me on the back is telling me, man, you're going to be a college player one day, you're going to be a pro one day. Well, that all sounds good, but at the end of the day, you know, athletes are built up, they think about it, and when it doesn't happen, the fall from that is devastating.
And then
you find yourself, when you fall, not having the skills to go out and compete in the real world with your peers for jobs.
So that's what this is primarily about, instilling those life skills, no matter what.
Absolutely. You know, Jabulani, everybody's career ends. Whether you play in high school or college, everybody's career ends. I've worked with a program at LSU for the last 2 years for a branding and transitioning program for professional football players. And what I've found is some guys had Super Bowl rings. Some guys had great pro bowlers. And these guys are still empty. So they've played careers. They've got money. But you know what? They're still empty. They're finished at 30, 31, and they don't know how to really go compete in the real world. And to be relevant.
What do you mean by empty?
Because when you've got an opportunity, when you play football, let's just say, all your life, and you get to the NFL is a life within itself. You know, it's almost like dog years. I mean, you know, you're 7 years as a dog. I mean, you're like really old. Well, you get the National Football League, and you come in at 22, you're out at 30, 8 years. That's a whole lifetime of a career. And so when you get out, all you've been in wrapped up in this NFL, which is kind of like the toy department of life, and you get outside, and you're like, you know what? I don't know how to do anything. I mean, you know, because nobody knows you. When the cheering stops, see, it all changes.
You're listening. Okay. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest today is Lamont Winston, former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs. He's joined the Oakland Raiders as director of player engagement, and they've changed the paradigm in the National Football League to player engagement under the new chief, Troy Vincent, a former defensive back in the NFL himself. Lamont, how do you deal, as you mentioned, when the cheering stops? How do you deal with some of the well-established athletes and still instill the same types of development tips, engagement, and cautionary tales as you would a young person? How do you tell star versus a person who's already established?
Yeah. First is stabilizing the player. It's stabilizing the player, knowing that he's getting ready to go, you know, down a road of depression, so to speak, disappointment, loss. So really, it's stabilizing the player and letting him know that, you know, there are resources and people in place to help them transition. A lot of times, you know, pro athletes don't know how to ask for help. Okay, when things are really, really close to them. And so it's really stabilizing the player and then showing them and creating an avenue for them to ask for help. And then, you know, as a resource, reaching out to help them, understanding what they're going through. That's the first step.
So, Mr. Winston, the draft is coming up this April. Take us through that point when a player is drafted or when a player is picked up by a team to when your job starts with that player and what happens from there. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, first of all, let's look at right now. Right now, everybody is being told they're going to be this draft pick, that draft pick, they're going to be this. Well, you know what? Nobody knows until the day of the draft. And you guys, everybody has seen all of the stories about guys that were projected first and second round picks don't go till the seventh or maybe free agents. So right now, everybody is feeling good about themselves. People are spending money, Jabalani, that they don't even have.
They are.
Yeah, they're spending money on cars, gifts. They're spending money on training at facilities, which, you know, includes apartments and food. And so they're spending money that they don't have. So pre-draft debt is accumulating as we speak. The draft comes, and all of a sudden, it's Christmas for probably 240 guys. Okay, some will have, you know, bigger presents, so to speak, than others. But at the end of the day, the reality sets in. Okay, so the expectations, and that's probably the biggest word, you know, expectation is so huge because, you know, you've been drafted, so you work for a club, okay, that you have to go there and earn the right. You've been drafted, but earn the right to stay. And you're going to be competing with men, professionals that have been doing this for a number of years. So they're way ahead of you, number one. Number two expectation is your family and friends. Everybody has their hand up. Everybody needs. So now the 22-year-old son, nephew, friend, cousin is now making decisions for grown people's lives because he has money and everybody wants some. Okay? He's walking into a multi-billion-dollar industry with real live billionaires, okay, and at 22 years old. And so the expectation of fans, okay, whether they're high school fans of theirs, college fans, now you walk into a pro city and you have expectations of those fans. And some of those expectations, Jabalani, are fans who didn't like you to be a draft pick for their team. Some loved you, so you walk into a love-hate relationship. All of that creates pressure. All of that can create distractions for a youngster. So as we all celebrate the draft and everybody's excited, you think about a 22-year-old man, young man, coming into, let's just don't make him a first-round draft pick. Let's put him in the middle rounds. And at the middle, he's going to make, you know, $300,000, $350,000. He's going from financial aid and scholarship money to $350,000 a year.
Which is a lot.
And he hasn't even made a team yet. Okay? So really my job starts right now. I'm preparing for our young guys we have here at the Raiders who, you know, are on our team and then, you know, setting the stage to get a support group to help those rookies that we end up getting. So it will make the transition a little bit easier, okay? But at the end of the day, you know, it starts when we get, you know, our new members to the Oakland Raiders.
We're on with the former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs, who has now joined the Oakland Raiders in a similar capacity as director of player engagement for that AFC rival there. We got Jake in South Kansas City who has a question for our guest, Lamont Winston. Jake, welcome to Central
State. Yes, good morning, fellows. And Mr. Winston, I find it a shame that we're talking to anybody from the Raiders. You know, this is just incongruous. But curious as to how young groups of people you deal with, athletes, and does the league have a dress code of any kind, you know, off-field, and what kind of recommendations, if any, do you make in these programs, you know, for young people coming out of high school, coming out of college, even, you know, in the pros about how to comport themselves, and is there a dress code?
Jake brings up good point. Lamont,
if you're asking me, Jake, about a kind of a dress code, like an appearance type code or state, if you will.
Jake, the dress code. It appears we've lost Jake, but Jake brings up an interesting point here. There's been a lot of discussion lately about dress codes and appearances, and you've been involved in branding. And the NBA had a similar issue a couple years back with controversy around Allen Iverson and the hip hop aesthetic in professional sports. Tell us about the dress code and comporting yourself, as our listener Jake has said.
Well, I think that, the only dress code that matters in the National Football League is on game day. Okay, and when you get off of when you get in your own personal time, and that's your own personal preference and your own personal taste. I think young athletes, young people, that starts with their parents. If their parents allow them to dress in ways that may be unbecoming, that's not necessarily on the young person. That's on the parent who's allowing that. Now, when you get to be an adult, obviously in this country, you can make your own choices and your own decisions. However, we do help our athletes understand that every time you step out the house, you're being interviewed. Okay, you're being interviewed for a future job. Your brand is being built whether you like it or not. And so if you want to be able to maximize your brand for future opportunities, then you need to pay attention to how you present yourself when you are off the football field.
Do you often find yourself in a position of sort of mediator between employer and employee as working with athletes?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, again, you know, this is a multi-billion-dollar industry, and there's only 32 like this in the world, period. There's only 32 franchises in the NFL franchises in the world. And so, you know, you have this is still a business. So young, the athletes, you know, sometimes they're so wrapped up in football, they really don't understand the dynamics of an organization and what it has to do on both sides to run effectively and maximize itself. And so, yeah, you know, there's constant dialogue between the players and the front office. So both can understand each other's world and be able to coexist, together so we can have maximum productivity here in the Oakland Raider organization.
Lamont, you went over to an AFC West rival. That just kind of happened because of the better opportunity?
Well, you know, obviously it was time. You know, my time in Kansas City had ended. To be quite honest, this is a gift from God. You know, I'm from Oakland, California. I grew up an Oakland Raider fan. You know, and when I, you know, as a child, so I went to elementary, high school, and all that stuff here in the Bay Area. And so this is coming home to actually really full circle to work for my childhood dream. You know, I was on loan, so to speak, to the Chiefs for a long time, and I loved it. I had no idea that my career would take me here, but now that I am here, it's still somewhat surreal seeing people that, you know, I spoke to a lot of my former high school teammates, and it's just kind of surreal walking into this building every day and being a part of something that really started me on my love for not only football, but for professional football.
Now that you're safe at home, are you willing to admit that you wore your Just Win Baby or Commitment to Excellence shirt under your Chiefs paraphernalia?
No, absolutely not. You know, no, absolutely not. I love nothing more than coming in the Coliseum and beating them, and I love nothing more than beating them at Arrowhead. You know, however, your first love is your first love, right, Jabulani?
Certainly, certainly, certainly. So how are you handling coming back and forth, family-wise, between Kansas City and Oakland, and who are you handing the torch on your local program pushing excellence to?
Well, in terms of my family, I have a beautiful wife, a very strong wife, Claire, two beautiful kids, Cameron and Alana, and they've, over the last 2 years, we've prepared ourselves for maybe an opportunity, and it would require me to have to go back and forth, and so they're stepping up. My family is tremendous, and so they're getting that done on our home front. In terms of pushing excellence, I have a tremendous team of people there to help us. We are now moving Pushing Excellence, Jabulani, into a nonprofit status. I think that it'll help our programming. It'll be more attractive to corporations to help fund our programming. But Kyle Dennis is acting as our operations director. Brad Cottom, a former chief, is on our staff, as well as Sean Barber, Jackie Thomas. And we have some people there who, Ruth Biggis, who's been tremendous in terms of keeping us relevant in the media and the high schools, and Mike Naster, who's a former great high school coach there in the Kansas City area. So our team, I've handed this off to the team, and like I told you on the, earlier, you know, the Pushing Excellence was designed to live on without Lamont Winston. I mean, you know, any great program or aspiring great program should not be based on one person.
Would you be looking to set that up in Oakland as well? Looking to expand
absolutely.
It?
Our goal is to be able to get our Kansas City model right and make it the flagship, and then be able to install this program in any school district in the country who'd be willing to have us.
Our guest is Lamont Winston. He's the former director of player development for the Kansas City Chiefs and has joined the Oakland Raiders as director of player engagement there. And his program here is called Pushing Excellence, that helps young people get ready for life, teaching them life skills. Thank you very much, Lamont Winston.
Jabulani, thank you for having me, and thank you, Kansas City.
All right. Tune in tomorrow for the Walt Bodine Show with co-host Monroe Dodd, looking at the implications of the 1940s census release. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi, executive produced by Bill Anderson, with help from Charlie Upchurch. Kim Noble is our announcer, and Emily Mutert manages our website at kcur.org, where you can go for today's podcast and other past shows. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney. The outro that you're hearing right now is performed by the Wilnots. Up to Date is next with a look at how Johnson County is changing. I'm Jabulani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.